Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
From the reading today, it should be clear why I believe Roger Williams is a great exemplar of some key Unitarian Universalist principles and a force for the best in the soul of America. In this time of political uncertainty and, dare I say, dread, it is good to find reasons for gratitude and admiration in our history. At this time, separation of church and state and individual freedom from state tyranny are under threat. President-elect Trump will likely appoint one or more Supreme Court justices that he hopes will overturn Roe versus Wade. Also, the state, in the form of, this is just one example, local police departments, has been shown to trample on the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness of quite a few African-American men in particular, who local police have shot to death, igniting the Black Lives Matter movement, and unfortunately a corresponding backlash among some white Americans, a backlash that helped elect Donald Trump. So how did a man born in 1603 become such a radical trailblazer? I want to start the incredible story of Roger Williams by putting him in historical context. Imagine it's the early 1600s. There was extreme and violent conflict between Catholics and Protestants in Europe and England. And it was over 100 years after Luther nailed his famous 95 Theses on the door of the Wittenberg Castle Church. The 30 Years' War was raging in Europe, and actually that term, the 30 Years' War, refers to a series of bloody wars over religion. It was 20 years before the English Civil War exploded between Protestants, largely Puritans, on one side, and King Charles and those who favored a more Catholic-like Church of England on the other. And it was just the time when English traders, adventurers, and Puritans seeking a safe haven began a trickle of emigration to the New World. This trickle became a flood once the Puritans of Plymouth Plantation, who came on the Mayflower in 1620, and then the settlements of Salem, Boston, Roxbury, Dorchester, New Haven, and others of the 1620s and 30s, showed that they could survive the shock of disease and New England winters. William's entire life was lived at the center of first this British power struggle and then an American Puritan power struggle. The religious and political dimensions overlapped. Religiously, it was the Anglican Church as it was, very influenced by Catholicism, versus those Protestants who would purify it, the Puritans. Politically, it was the monarchy versus Parliament. The monarchy, King James and then King Charles, wished to preserve the church as it was. And by the way, it was King James who introduced the notion of the divine right of kings into English law, and the same King James who commissioned a new biblical translation. It's no accident that the King James Bible increased the emphasis on obedience to authority. On the other hand, Parliament represented the people. Parliament was largely Protestant and Puritan, and it drew its authority from the English common law. So it was against this backdrop that Roger Williams made his first big career move. As a boy of 13, it was around 1616, and he met the man who was to become his biggest influence, Sir Edward Coke, one of the greatest lawyers and judges in British history. Cook noticed that Williams had an invaluable skill that lawyers needed. Can you imagine what that might be? It was shorthand. Shorthand. Cook needed someone to take detailed legal notes, and this began an extremely close, almost father and son lifelong relationship. You know the saying, and it's not gender neutral, that a man's home is his castle? It was Cook who said, "An Englishman's house is as his castle, and each man's home his safest refuge." This statement carved out a space of privacy and individual rights that the state could not touch. For each free man, each Englishman, and that covered his family, each Englishman had a castle, just like the monarch, and a safe refuge from authoritarian power. Now, Cook spent his life challenging the crown and championing individual rights against arbitrary state and royal power. He had great and powerful clients, but as John Barry writes, his greatest and most important client was the very law itself, the common law of England. We owe so much to English common law. It consists of many different ancient traditions of rights that were made common, meaning consistent, throughout England, way back in the 1200s under Henry III. And this is how crimes such as murder first became violations of the state, not just persons. So earlier, even murder could often be resolved privately by the perpetrator paying money simply to the victim's family. It wasn't a crime against the state. And besides common law, rights and liberties were based on the Magna Carta, whose full name was the Magna Carta Libertatum, the Great Charter of Liberties. This was forced upon King John in 1215 by a group of feudal barons to limit the king's powers and guarantee their rights in law. And even this drew on more ancient traditions and charters, stating things like, "No free man shall be taken or imprisoned or exiled, but by the lawful judgment of his peers or by the law of the land." Of course, the circle of those who have rights has been continuously enlarged through struggle, expanding to all male property owners, not just barons and aristocrats, then all free men, then all men, and shockingly, even women, and then even some rights for children. This was the English heritage of rights on which Roger Williams and his mentor Cook drew, sometimes at the risk of their very lives. In fact, often. Cook had many clashes with King James, and young Roger Williams was there at every moment, writing busily in shorthand of this historic struggle. He was there the very next day after Cook blocked special religious court charges against a layman. And Cook said, quote, "The ecclesiastical judge cannot examine any man upon the intention and thought in his heart. For it hath been said in the proverb, thought is free." Now, Williams had a second great mentor, and this was Sir Francis Bacon. We know him as a brilliant intellectual and pioneer of the scientific method. The same year the Mayflower carried desperate Puritans to America in 1620, Bacon published his astonishing work, Novum Organum, True Directions into the Interpretation of Nature. In it, he rejected both Aristotle's and the Scholastics' pure logical approach to truth, which was kind of following logic regardless of any evidence, and then the other extreme, known as empiricism. And this was the idea that all knowledge comes from immediate sensory experience, but unguided by any theory or ideas. Instead, Bacon advocated for careful experimentation and observation to develop theory, the modern scientific method we have used ever since. Well, Williams read this work and was deeply influenced by the idea that you must approach the world neither blinded by your own assumptions nor without guiding beliefs. He held firm to his Puritan religious beliefs, but in particular, Bacon's scientific method of openness and experimentation without prejudgment seemed to influence Williams in many ways, including how he interacted with Indians. More on that shortly. So imagine for a moment that you had two brilliant mentors, that you were a charming, brilliant, promising young minister and a Puritan reformer. Like Cook, with whom you worked day in and day out, you would have learned deep courage and intellectual integrity, even risking death. You would have seen in the entwined religious-political cataclysm the dangers of mixing church and state. As a Puritan, your starting point would always be God's commandments as stated in the Bible. But after that, following Sir Francis Bacon, you would be open to new experiences as evidence about the world. Well, Williams graduated from Cambridge University, and he was a passionate Puritan and a minister, then still in the Church of England, but of course he was a controversial dissenter. And the ever-increasing pressure and persecution of Puritans eventually led to his fleeing England on the ship the Lion in 1631. Now, that year before, as was mentioned in the reading, in 1630, almost 1,000 Puritan men and women, with John Winthrop, sailed to Massachusetts because, even though they considered themselves loyal members of the Church of England, they wished to reform it, which was completely taboo to both king and church. When they arrived, John Winthrop was the governor, became governor of the Boston settlement. And then, a year later, when the ship the Lion was unloading in 1631, and not indeed when the Mayflower landed in 1620, it was then that the governor declared what became the first Thanksgiving. So it was when Roger Williams' ship actually landed. Now, Williams had an excellent reputation as a clergyman, even among those like Winthrop who disagreed with him. But naturally, he immediately got off to a bad start. He turned down a position as theologian with the Boston Church after meeting with church leaders and finding in them remnants of the corrupt Church of England in their practices. So that wasn't politically a wise move if he was a careerist. Soon his critiques grew more radical. The Massachusetts Bay Colony was in practice a theocracy, but Williams argued that magistrates had no power to enforce the first four commandments, which were only between an individual and his or her God. To have no God before him, make no graven images, not take the Lord's name in vain, and to keep the Sabbath holy. He was laying the groundwork in America for separation of church and state. This was risky for Williams in both the Bay Colony and back in England. And not only that, Williams was highly controversial for his treatment of indigenous peoples. Consider this. Now, converting Indians was the main justification for getting royal charters to establish settlements in America, which all these Puritans had to do. Puritans sincerely did want to convert Indians for their good and salvation, to sanctify the world which would bring Christ's return. And they also wanted to prevent the spread of Catholicism by French and Spanish colonial rivals. But in actual fact, these Puritan settlements made very little effort to convert Indians. But actually, Williams did. He traveled and traded among several tribes. He used a canoe for 50 years, which may have strengthened him and helped him live to the age of 80. He entertained Indians in his home, both to evangelize, but also out of the curiosity that Bacon had displayed as a scientist. He wanted to convert, not by force. He believed no one could become a true Christian without fully understanding what it meant. So therefore, he made no such efforts until he was fluent in their languages. Virtually the only settler to do that at that time. His experience led him to claim, quote, "Nature knows no difference between Europe and Americans," by which he meant Native Americans, "in blood, birth, bodies, etc. His sincere belief in their essential equality was highly unusual. An early anthropologist, he wrote, quote, "The sociableness of the nature of man appears in the wildest of them who love society, families, cohabitation, and consociation of houses and towns together. The wildest of the sons of men have found a necessity to cast themselves into some mold or form of government." End quote. For him, what made Indians different was their lack of European knowledge and technology, not race. And he learned a lot from them. For example, the use of controlled burns to clear underbrush and let new trees grow. But William's most radical belief about Native Americans challenged the entire rationale for Europeans taking American land. That rationale was that the land was unoccupied and unused. Indians were seen as just mere savages roaming randomly. Well, Williams was grounded in English common law, which linked rights to property. And he observed that the Indians used the land and concluded that therefore they owned the land. He wrote, quote, "The natives are very exact and punctual in the bounds of their lands, belonging to this or that prince or people. And I have known them to make bargain and sale amongst themselves for a small piece or quantity of ground." By rights, therefore, to Williams, no English king could grant what he did not own unless he purchased it from its rightful owners. That was radical for 1630. It's kind of still radical today. Williams took these concerns privately to other Puritan leaders, and as you can imagine, they were completely explosive. But what really endangered him even more was the claim that, quote, "No church or person can have power over another church." Congregational polity threatened the central authority, the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which relied on total obedience to central state authority. But Williams just would not stop. He challenged the Bay Colony's religious compulsory loyalty oath because it produced hypocrisy, since non-believers who made this oath profaned God. He attacked anything imposed on individuals without their consent. And most profoundly for the heritage of the United States, he echoed his mentor, Sir Edward Coke, by claiming, "No man may be punished for his thoughts, expanded to include the freedom to speak one's thoughts." Well, that was when he was banished from all Puritan colonies, in the middle of an especially brutal New England winter. He was close to the Wampanoag tribe, which sheltered him, and particularly close to the Narragansetts and their chiefs. They gave Williams permission to settle within certain boundaries in what is now Rhode Island. He became a farmer, followers joined him, and the colony was slowly established. Regardless of Williams' extreme personal religiosity, which infused every aspect of a Puritan's life, the Providence Government Compact excised all mention of God. This was unique among all European founding documents. John Winthrop in the Massachusetts Bay Colony held that the government's power to rule came from God and was accountable only to God. But of course, human beings in power interpreted what they wanted. Williams, in contrast, was developing the idea that governments, quote, "received their authority from and were responsible to their citizens." He and the Rhode Island founders wrote into their legal compact that no community member be accounted a delinquent for or because of doctrine. That is, they established freedom of religion. This was because Williams thought any enforcement of God's law relied on human interpretation. And humans were imperfect. Inevitably, they would err in discerning God's law. In his view, and that of our constitutional framers about 160 years later, quote, "Congress, or any government body, shall make no law that would establish a state religion." Well, as the decades after 1630 passed, the New England settlements formed an alliance called the United Colonies, Massachusetts Bay, Plymouth, Connecticut, and New Haven. All of them continually attempted land grabs of Rhode Island, which they called, quote, a sewer that would allow any scum to live there. They wanted the land. So the only way to ensure the survival of Rhode Island was to get a royal charter from England for Rhode Island. So in 1644, Williams went back to England to lobby and secure it. That year, in 1644, Williams laid out his beliefs in a pamphlet. He argued that church and state should be separated for the sake of the church. Like his mentor Francis Bacon, he looked at the evidence and concluded every time the wall between church and state was broken, the church had been corrupted by the state or by politics. Williams said, if you mix religion and politics, you get politics. He was not writing to a Rhode Island or the New World type of readership. He was writing for a British and European readership. And finally, he argued that Rhode Island deserved a charter that granted individual religious liberty because it was a test case that could be observed by Europe safely from across the Atlantic. Well, there isn't time to tell you how he made it work, but somehow it worked. And when he got the charter in 1644, it permitted the Rhode Island colony to be governed by majority rule. Williams' vision was democracy, and Rhode Island was the freest society in the Western world. Williams then wrote a 400-page book more fully outlining his arguments. He had to write it anonymously. His printer had to flee England with him back to the colonies. His use of observation and evidence, scientific method, shows the influence of Francis Bacon, while his vision of liberty shows the influence of Cook. But his argument was his own. Interestingly, for a free-thinking rebel, Roger Williams was able to maintain relationships with powerful Puritan and Protestant leaders back in England. Once Rhode Island had become a viable, well-populated settlement on land Williams had legitimately purchased from Indians, Williams was usually able to get the support he needed from back home, though often with enormous effort, public relations, and strategy. It also may be that the English leaders wanted a counterbalance to the power of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, so they may have had their reasons. Amazingly, Williams' Rhode Island was an experiment in free thought unique in the world, well over a century before the American Revolution, a century and a half before the French Revolution. In these political times, we will be challenged greatly by far greater powers than the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Private corporations, as we know them today, did not then exist. Excuse me. Misplaced a page. There we go. Also, the challenges of ethnic and cultural diversity that we have among us would have been astounding to him. We live in a time when one of the pillars of democracy, a free and responsible press, struggles to exist, replaced for many by social media, where separate silos of different ideologies never meet in an open contest of ideas, as they did often not long ago. Many citizens believe all manner of lies and twisted ideologies. Our democracy has never been challenged quite like this. As we face the conflicts ahead, we can look back to Roger Williams. In a time of lies, we look back to him for his openness to the truths he discovered through clear-eyed observation. In a time of corruption, and there is always some corruption, we look back to Williams for his integrity. In a time when the alt-right social media, known for its white male supremacist aims, is represented in the president-elect's chief strategist, Steve Bannon, We look to Williams for his egalitarian vision. In the months and years to come, we can look back to him above all for his courage. We will need that courage to pursue our vision of a world that protects the vulnerable, a world of equality, freedom, and justice. May it be so.